Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. Today, our goals are to draw to a conclusion our ongoing discussion of Shakespeare's problem comedy, so-called Measure for Measure, and talk about some of the implications of its ending and its overall theme, and then go on to introduce the genre of Shakespeare's final four plays, which are known as the romances. Another name for them, an intriguing one that we will return to, is also tragicomedies. And we will be moving after that to the last and greatest of those four romances, The Tempest, one of Shakespeare's great plays, one of the famous plays of the world, and basically his going out play in his career as a man of the theater. But to return to Measure for Measure, to try to remind us of the complicated, to say the least, plot, Angelo has been put in charge of Vienna as ruler and judge. The Duke, who is the normal ruler, has pretended to go out of town for reasons that are never clear, but really has returned in disguise as a friar. Why he's doing this, don't ask, don't tell, but we will concern ourselves at least with asking the question in a little while. But at any rate, this is what he does. Angelo, almost immediately, proves corrupt the minute that he is given a temptation, and it attempts to extort Isabella to basically have sex with him, or he will go through with the execution of her brother, Claudio, whose crime, so-called, is to have gotten his fiancée pregnant before the wedding. At that point, the Duke, disguised as a friar, steps in and produces Mariana, a second woman. And we learn that Mariana had been engaged previously, before the play began, to Angelo. But Angelo not only broke the engagement when he learned that her dowry had disappeared, but spread nasty rumors about her chastity on the Renaissance equivalent of the internet. So he was a nasty fellow even before the extortion plot that he has hatched here in the play. Nonetheless, Mariana is still interested in Angelo. We will also have to ask ourselves why, but nevertheless, she is still interested, and the Duke, disguised as the friar, contrives a plot whereby Mariana will meet, disguised as Isabella, will meet with Angelo, go through with what the tradition calls the bed trick, the substitution of one woman for another in the dark. If you ask whether this ever plausibly could occur in real life, I'm not going there. You can decide that. But at any rate, it is actually a formula that has been used elsewhere, not just in this play. Mariana substitutes for Isabella, and at least in this play, it fools Angelo. Nonetheless, he double-crosses Isabella and orders the execution of Claudio anyway. The Duke, disguised still as the friar, heads that off, no pun intended, because the head of an already expired criminal in the jails is substituted for the head of Claudio as proof of his execution, and then announces that he is returning as the Duke. And that brings us to Act Five, in which he does, in the opening of it, Act Five is one tour de force act and scene. It is not subdivided. It is a continuous recognition scene. Aristotle speaks of the device of recognition or anagnorisis in his work, The Poetics. And this has been used as a common critical tool for all these thousands of years. The recognition can be on the part of the characters or on the part of the audience or both. Here, the Duke is returning. He comes back. He gets rid of Friar's robes and comes back as the Duke at the beginning of Act Five. And it is multiple recognitions cascading one upon the heels of the other for the rest of the act and the outcome of those recognitions. Duke walks in the door, so to speak. Isabella immediately makes a public accusation of Angelo. The Duke pretends not to believe her, though of course he knows better. Why is he doing this? Well, maybe we'll get there. But at any rate, he plays along and says, okay, first she's mad, then he pretends to be angry. She's not only mad, she's a troublemaker. Arrest her and find this friar that she says has set her on to these false accusations. Obviously false, because our good Angelo has a reputation that is impregnable. And Mariana joins in and seconds the motion with Isabella. And the order is, okay, arrest her too. The Duke at that point leaves, which is not the first time he's suddenly done that, and tells Angelo, try your own case. Well, there's a nice impartial jury for you. But at any rate, try your own case, Angelo. And anyway, it's completely fake, because what the Duke needs to do, like Clark Kent needing a chance to turn into Superman, is to go off stage, get rid of put Friar's robes back on, and come back in as the friar temporarily. The friar appears, and again, the accusation. So we have a triple accusation. Isabella, Mariana, Friar Lodowick, as the Duke is calling himself. And finally, Lucio, the smart aleck, goes up to the friar and says, all right, you, we're going to see who's really under this friar's hood, and unhoods him. And, uh-oh, it's the Duke. And Lucio and everybody else suddenly realizes that it's hit the fan. Time for a last judgment, so to speak. And the Duke begins judging. His first command, Mariana, go with Angelo and get married so that your reputation will be repaired. Then, justice for Isabella. After you are married to Angelo, we will execute him for what he has done, or at least what he has tried to do. And lest the audience forget the title of the play that they've been watching, the Duke spells it out. An Angelo for Claudio, death for death. Haste still pays haste, and leisure answers leisure. Like doth quit like, and measure still for measure. Measure for measure, or as the Old Testament put it, an eye for an eye. That's justice, at least in one manner of speaking. But now the two women. First, Mariana, who says, please, to the Duke, have mercy, because I still want him. Her exact words are, O my dear Lord, I crave no other nor no better man. And we are perhaps incredulous. Can you really mean that? Are you suffering from abused housewife syndrome or something? Don't you need therapy for this? Mariana goes on and says this. they say best men are molded out of faults, and, for the most, become much the more the better for being a little bad. So may my husband. We really, in our day and age, are brought up short and have to think about that. In the age of post-Me Too, when so much has come out about the abuse of women, both by people in office and domestically, and the women who stand by their man, is there something wrong there? Wrong with the woman, wrong with that decision? I mean, this man was not caught in minor infractions. He would have basically raped by extortion a woman who was on the verge of becoming a nun, and basically judicially murdered her brother, double-crossing her in the extortion. Not to mention the way he treated Mariana in the past, breaking the engagement and spreading slanderous rumors. We're not talking minor foibles here. And this troubles us. We have to decide what we think of this. However, Mariana pleads to Isabella. And then, because of that, Isabella kneels before the Duke and gives this speech. I feel that, in a sense, the whole play has worked towards putting Isabella in the time and the place to give this speech. She says to the Duke, "Most bounteous sir, look, if it please you, on this man condemned, as if my brother lived." I partly think a due sincerity governed his deeds till he did look on me. Since it is so, let him not die. My brother had but justice in that he did the thing for which he died. For Angelo, his act did not o'ertake his bad intent, and must be buried but as an intent that perished by the way. Thoughts are no subjects, intents but merely thoughts. This from the woman who, several acts previously, a very different Isabella perhaps at that point, said to her terrified brother facing death, begging her to consider sleeping with Angelo to spare his life, that she would pray 1,000 prayers for his death, for his suggesting such a thing. This is as great a reversal as it is possible to have. And we wonder, what has happened here? Isabella, throughout the play, would normally be outfitted in a production in a nun's habit because she was in a convent, just had not taken the final vows yet. In her heartless treatment of her brother, she was anything but Christian, and we clearly have to question whether she truly had a vocation to be a nun, given that no Christian believing in compassion and forgiveness of sins could possibly have spoken to her own brother that way without a shred of sympathy. Here, she has every reason to absolutely hate Angelo, who she sincerely believes at this point treacherously killed her brother, but begs forgiveness for him. Why? Partly, perhaps, she has finally realized that the essence of Christianity, perhaps the essence of humanity, is forgiveness, forgiveness of one another. And I would very definitely add that she also does it not just on general principles. She is also doing it for a woman friend. I spoke last time, I believe, of the importance of the theme of women's friendship, as far back as Midsummer Night's Dream, where the two women are close and have been close since childhood, and their friendship is part of the play. This is very unusual. Friendship between men was a common theme, and Shakespeare deals with that too in plays like Two Gentlemen of Verona. That was an age-old theme, the nobility of friendship between two men. And that runs through the whole of the Western tradition, even in the Bible, David and Jonathan. But the friendship of women, the usual sexist attitude is, well, they're not important enough to consider their private lives. But this is friendship for another woman that will she will forgive Angelo what he did for the sake, in part, of Isabella. Does she do it in part even for Angelo? You know, she says, I partly think she's struggling with it. A due sincerity governed his deeds till he did look on me. Again, in a post-Me Too world, this makes us uncomfortable because it could be construed, and I imagine there are critics who construe this as quite wrong, that it seems to go along with the idea that rape is because women tempt men, even by the way they look. That, well, they had it coming because, you know, it's their fault for being attractive and being vulnerable. But she is granting him the benefit of a doubt and wishing not for judgment, not for justice, but for mercy. Those are the twin poles, really, of human life, but certainly coming out of the biblical tradition. It was traditional that God had two sides, a side of justice and therefore wrath and law, and a side of mercy, love and forgiveness. Both are aspects of the divine nature, and therefore both are incumbent upon us. An earlier play, The Merchant of Venice, is also concerned with justice and mercy, though the issue there is unfortunately obscured by the anti-Semitism surrounding the figure of Shylock. Here, however, it's not obscured by anything. It's front and center, and we have to decide what we think of it. Where the play will end up in terms of plot, despite it being truly indeed a problem comedy, as it has been called, it ends in the traditional way with multiple weddings or possible weddings. Here we have as many as four possible marriages, and all of them, in a certain way, problematic. It is a problem play in some ways of thinking. We have Claudio and Giulietta. Claudio is not going to be executed out of this absurd law, and he's going to get married to the woman that he loves, the woman who is pregnant by him, and they are secretly, legally engaged. There is no problem there whatsoever by modern standards or by Shakespeare's time. This was utterly unreasonable, and now we're going to have a happy ending. But In the process, Claudio had to go through a terrible ordeal, and we have to, again, look at the fact that the Duke really engineered this. He not only let it take place, he actively puppeteered and pulled strings to put Claudio, as well as other people, through various ordeals. And he put Claudio through an ordeal of being jailed with execution pending the next day. Why? Apparently, so Claudio could learn what he was really made of. All Shakespeare's comedies, the sympathetic characters undergo ordeals in order to get to the happy ending. And it's the ordeals out of which things change and twist around to a desired outcome. But in this play, the ordeals have the additional function of showing people what they really are, making them look in a mirror and really seeing themselves. Claudio did escape, and he is a good man, but we do remember that as heroes go, he was not very heroic by the cliched standards of heroic romantic leads. He was willing to beg his sister to consider having sex with a rapist in order to spare his life. And he'll have to live with that knowledge as best he can. That's an aspect, the play does not dwell on it, but we just think, okay, this is how it's going to be after the fifth act closes. Lucio is being legally required to marry the prostitute that he got pregnant and skipped out on. You could say that's not very nice to the prostitute, but at least it will mean that she and the child will be supported. They will get child support out of this, and that was clearly the idea. And besides, Lucio, who is a ne'er-do-well, regards having to marry anybody, and especially having to marry a prostitute, as a horrible fate. This is a man who refused to defend Pompey because it is not the mode. That is, you're not respectable, and I'm not going to be caught trying to defend or back you up because I only want to hang out around the respectable crowd. So now you have to marry the prostitute that you got pregnant anyway. The third possible wedding left hanging in the air is that the Duke, of all things, what's going on, proposes to Isabel. I have a motion much imports your good, whereto, if you'll a willing ear incline, what's mine is yours, and what is yours is mine. Well, for crying out loud, I don't know how many times I'll have to say, what do we make of this, wrapping up this play, but what do we make of this? We feel, perhaps, that in one way it's okay because we're pretty much convinced that Isabella did not really have a religious vocation and that leaving the cloister is perhaps a return to the reality from which she fled, being young, fearful, and unwilling to face the fact that it's a very imperfect and sometimes outright corrupt world out there. She wanted to be sheltered from that. And maybe the Duke is a good match because he seems to be the type that likes to skip out on things as well, including his responsibilities. He says in the first act that he has not tried to enforce this stupid law that's been lying on the books for an entire generation because he's afraid of how unpopular it would make him. He does claim that he has ever aspired to know himself. Well, maybe he has, and maybe he realizes it's time to act a little more real and live a bit more of a real life, and maybe this is not a bad idea. The lines I read were almost the last lines of the play, And in the last production of Measure for Measure that I can remember seeing at Stratford, Ontario, the two are simply left on stage at that point, looking at each other. They could reach out and take hands, but then the play ends. But it's possible. And fourth and last, Angelo and Mariana, who bring to focus the whole emphasis of the play on justice and mercy. And what we think of it depends on the issue that the play raises really rather explicitly very early on, before we're out of the first act, and that is human nature innately bad, innately flawed? Is there a streak of evil in it? The religious tradition says yes. In Catholic tradition, this is original sin. The doctrine is that the sin of Adam and Eve comes down on the soul of every human being and is there at birth. From birth, we have the streak of evil that comes from the fall. Human nature is innately evil, and even a newborn baby is worthy of hell. And it is only out of divine grace and the beneficence of God that anyone gets saved, because everyone, from their first breath on this earth, deserves to be damned. Protestantism is a disparate phenomenon, but the most prominent variety of it in England in Shakespeare's time was Puritanism, and the Puritans espoused the theology of Calvin. And in Calvinism, the theology states that human beings are subject to innate depravity. Their version of original sin makes it sound uglier, but it's basically a version of the same thing. Everyone is innately depraved at the core, and we have to depend on being saved. We cannot save ourselves, therefore, but have to hope that we are saved, have faith that we can be saved from the outside. What does Measure for Measure as a play tell us? Does not seem to endorse any hard line idea of human depravity. We should not miss the fact that there are at least two characters who seem totally upright, who do not seem to be flawed. One of them upper level in terms of social class, and one common level. There is Aeschylus, who is simply a wonderful man, comparable in the play that we'll be turning to in The Tempest to Gonzalo, the aged courtier, just a good, good man, and who always espouses mercy and giving the benefit of a doubt when he is a judge. And on the common level, the provost, who is the keeper of the jail, the person of no eminent social class at all, but the Duke comes to be quite impressed with him, and we are too. He's a genuinely good man. He wants things to come out for the good, and he cannot be corrupted and bribed. The Duke, disguised as the friar, tries to do that. And the provost, though he would stand to gain from this, says, "This is against the rules of my job. I will not do it." So there are people who do not fall. Whether they're tempted or not, we are not shown, but they simply are guilty of nothing that needs to be forgiven, at least in the course of this play. And both of them are concerned with the quality of mercy. However, then there's the rest of the characters, you might say. The play does affirm a need for law, because there is a streak of evil. It may not be so dominant as conservative religious tradition asserts. Nevertheless, we can't simply abolish the law, because some people are evil, some people are not evil, but temptable if given the occasion. Much of the play turns on what would happen. Okay, you're upright now, you have a clean conscience, but is that only because you've never been tempted, or if you were tempted, you were too afraid of what might happen so that you chickened out of actually doing something evil? And that's why we have to know ourselves. We don't know how evil we could be until we're tempted. That's why the Duke is doing all this. Whether as a human being and not God, he has a right to play with human lives like this is another question. But nevertheless, we have the law, but the law is not sufficient. The law in this play, for one thing, is a stupid law that you execute somebody for getting their girlfriend pregnant before the wedding. Laws are not sufficient because they're crafted by human beings, and they have a tendency to trap the innocent or relatively innocent, like Claudio, and let the wicked, like Angelo, escape. Come up with your own examples in our time, and if you lack them, look at the news. Therefore, the law is not enough. And also, the agents of the law are corruptible, and that is also in the play. So we must go beyond the law. To what? From the letter of the law to the spirit of the law, and the spirit of the law. The letter of the law enforces justice, but it's imperfect, so we have to go beyond the letter to the spirit of the law, which is allied with or identical to mercy. And if we look at the people in this play, Angelo is the chief one who needs some mercy, and he does get it. We are not comfortable with it. Nonetheless, Mariana knows what she wants, and she has some faith, some hope that love might turn around this very fallible man who fell and who is now being given another chance. Will he take it? We're not sure. It is troubling in the play that Angelo never expresses remorse. And it fits his character. He is very strict and proud. He is super proud. And now his pride has been crushed. He's not only failed to uphold his high standards that he looks down upon everybody else for not coming up to, but he's been publicly exposed. And it may be that he's simply too humiliated to gasp out even a little word of remorse for having hurt Mariana, for having done his best to hurt Isabella and Claudio. We'd be happy if he made even a couple of lines act of contrition here, but Mariana lives on hope. And how far is that a model for us in this world becomes a very good question. The problem aspect of the play reaches out and becomes relevant to us because, of course, we're talking about our actions here in this so-called real world. What of the Duke? He meddles around, and he is not perfect either. He makes misjudgments, he has his foibles, and so forth. But we do have to say that in his puppeteering, he pulls off some sort of outcome that, whether you call it happy or not, it's better than it would have been without. And he changes people. He brings about marriages and good outcomes externally. He has also helped people to come to know themselves. Perhaps Isabella now realizes that her reasons for being a nun were basically kind of neurotic. He has shown Claudio that he's a rather fallible fellow. He has shown Angelo big time what he's made of, and so forth and so on. And he says he wants to come to know himself. And perhaps he has in some ways. Is the Duke an agent of some higher power working towards a happy ending is a question. The Duke has been taken at times to symbolize something religious because of the relentless religious language of the play. He's not God, he's not a Christ figure, and much emphasis is placed on his fallibility, but people have pointed out, how do you address, if you ever meet a Duke, how should you address him? As your grace. Without grace, we are predestined to damnation because of our corrupt nature. Grace is not just a reprieve or pardon. Grace can transform human nature. And grace is unpredictable. At an earlier point in the play, there is the line, on whom it will. And that is true of punishment, but that is true also of grace. Is there something moving behind the Duke, using the Duke as a fallible but real instrument to bring about this happy ending? Shakespeare cannot perhaps be pinned down about that. But the question for us is, how far forgiveness of sins goes, both our own and others. And the meaning of the title phrase thereby changes. In the beginning, and even there, when I just quoted it in Act 5, it's been used in an Old Testament sense, measure for measure, an eye for an eye. But it changes in that fifth act to do your best to forgive others and bear with their weaknesses, even their evils, as you yourself would be forgiven, echoing perhaps something like the Lord's Prayer. How far must we push ourselves to do that? And as for Isabella accepting a very flawed man, I always think of this play in conjunction with W.H. Auden's wonderful poem, As I Walked Out One Evening. And the lines, you shall love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart. Because that's what love is. There is no perfect love. There is no perfect lover. Nor would we perhaps be deserving of a perfect love and lover ourselves, because we are flawed. The essence is trying to forgive rather than pride and self-righteousness, rather than revenge. All these issues do not disappear when we move, as we will next week, to the romances. And in fact, the romances are the culmination of the tradition of Shakespearean comedy. And we will turn to them and to The Tempest next week.